Hello there, and you are very welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. Champions Cup semi-final weekend, Leinster and Northampton Saints meeting at the Aviva Stadium on Saturday evening, Bordeaux and Toulouse then on Sunday. We also have a whitewash needed to talk about this weekend in the BKT, United Rugby Championship. All four Irish provinces losing last weekend. Along with that as well, Ireland also beaten by Scotland in the final round of the Guinness Women's Six Nations. So five defeats in the space of 24 hours for Irish teams. Later on, I'll be chatting to Linda Dugang about that. For now, though, Bernard Jackman and Johnny Holland are with me. And Johnny, first up, commiserations on Sunday. Corcon beaten by Clontarf in the AIL final, 22-21. I imagine a tough defeat to deal with. It's been another big season coming in as defending champions. Everyone's been talking about it for the guts of 20 years. No one has managed to retain that title. You came bloody close, though.
We did come close, and I think that's the hard part. You know, it's forgive my voice, but it's definitely not an easy one to take. Like, and sometimes, you know, you come out with a big front, being like, yeah, look, we were second best on the day, blah blah blah. It's tough. Like, don't get anyone wrong. It's very tough. So, I don't know. I haven't watched it back. I remember a lot of incidents. Clontarf for class, right? I mean, every time you look at the start of the season, you'll be wondering who's going to be there, thereabouts. I hope people would recognise that we have been there, thereabouts for a long time now, but Clontarf are always there. And it, like, as long as I've been playing and coaching, they have been there. So you can't argue with it. Like, they're a good side, well set up, well coached, well executed, but it doesn't make it any easier. Like,
yeah, absolutely. And like I would say, like, you know, I was there on Sunday as well. Gun to my head, I would say Clontarf were the better team over the course of the 80 minutes. But there was part of me, like, for a good chunk of that game, I did actually think he might go ahead and get the job done, just because it looked like every time he got an opportunity, he were taking it. And Clontarf were probably having to work a lot harder for the scores they were getting. And the longer that game wore on, it was probably until Clontarf got that try with 7 or 8 minutes to go that I probably was actually thinking he were going to do it, even if I thought Clontarf were the more dominant team.
They were more dominant, but I think, like, going in at 14-12 at half time was a bit of a miracle. But when a team does that, you're thinking it has to shift at some stage, you know. But
obviously you had that big defensive stand on half time as well, which felt like a massive moment.
Yeah, so we were 14-12. I think we had two 22 meter entries. We scored off both of them, converted well by JT, but we knocked down one transfer in a mall just in front of me, actually. So that would be kind of three attempts, maybe. It wasn't in the 22, but it was close. So in my own head, we had kind of three good clear-cut chances and we converted two, but, you know, we gave Clontarf a lot of the ball. I've spoken about how I thought it was a possession-based game and we didn't have a lot of possession in the first half. So going in at halftime, 14-12 was miraculous. And then I think the third quarter, this is off memory now as opposed to analysis, but the third quarter, we were just inaccurate. You know, we had probably had opportunities to get our actual stamp on the game and we were inaccurate. And then, you know, like, I spoke to Conor Kelly after the game, so this isn't a dig by any means, but, like, there was points left on the tee from Clontarf, and one of those was the missed penalty where they had the drop out and they scored that try in the end. So you can never say, like, 11 points on the tee, but because one of them turned into a 7-pointer and the winning of the game in the end, so it's funny how things work out. But they probably had a couple of opportunities to find a bit of space on us as well and didn't take them. So I don't even say they weren't valued for their win. Like you said, they were probably the better team on the day. We could well have won it. And I think if we had done it, you'd say we would have deserved it because of what we had done throughout the game, but we didn't do that, you know. So they were full value for their win. But it's difficult because I think there were things within our control that we could have gone after and we didn't, like, you know. So lessons learned. When I do eventually watch it back, I might learn a thing or two about a final. I'm not sure if I will watch it, but that's not a professional thing to say, is it?
Bernard, is it oversimplifying it to say that Hugh Cooney was the difference between the two teams?
Well, he had a major influence. Look, there's a lot of really good talent on that pitch on both sides, but he did stand out, didn't he? It kind of reminded you of the Joey Carberry effect when he led Tarf to a final. He just involved in big moments, and that's what those really talented players tend to do. And speaking to people from Tarf during the year, because we haven't seen a huge amount of him for Leinster, but obviously Farrell and his scouts rate him highly. He was picked to train with Ireland as a development player, And I spoke to some people in Clontarf, and they said this guy is the real deal. You know, he's the real deal. And they're used to, like Conor, used to professional players or academy players coming back. And you know, they have a fair understanding of what someone with the talent to go a bit further, and like Ty Furlong and those guys would have done it earlier in their career for Tarf. So yeah, and I think he showed because that's the league this year, the 1A in particular, is a very high standard. And if you can go in a game like that under the pressure that's there and have as many big moments as him, I think it's a real positive sign that he's someone that we would see a lot more of in Irish rugby. I just think Con Clontarf, like they're kind of always there, and that takes serious doing to come back year after year. And obviously both clubs have been lucky enough to win it numerous times, which obviously feeds that energy. But like this year, you know, there was St. Mary's, there was Lansdowne, you know, Terenure were still there. It was an unbelievably competitive 1A, and even the semi-finals were incredibly close. But Con, the only thing I'd say if the Con is like they never give up, and that's kind of what you want if you're a supporter or a player to be playing with people that don't give up. And it was an amazing final, and fair play to Clontarf. But I think the AIL at the moment is absolutely booming.
It should,
yeah, Johnny. Like,
the top 6-7 teams, it's absolutely shit crack week to week. You're like,
yeah, it's good.
It's for the neutrals, it's class for people that support the AIL. It's actually never been as strong, I would say. But yeah. Oh, it's such a tough gig when you're looking at the next team, you're going, Jesus, everyone beats everyone. Like, it's so.
Yeah. No, I hear you.
And like, you know, following on from that, like, it does, like, even just looking at the last three finals speaks to the fact that the Division 1A in particular is in such rude health, because that's 3 years in a row now where the defending champions have lost in the final. Obviously, ye did it to Terenure last year. Terenure did it to Clontarf the year before. Like, it's so hard to win that league, obviously.
It is. It's and that's why, like, I think being so close to it, and everyone, I'd have my complaints about one or two things, but that's not strong enough. Like, it's so ratty in the last when you start complaining about things like that. I thought we were very close to it, and one or two things going our way, we could well have done the business, and I think that's what makes it so hard. But look, like was on, if it was that easy to win an AIL and go back to back and everything else, like, you know, we've tried to say that to the lads in a way. If it was that easy, it's not worth it when you do win it, like, you know. So great product, absolutely fantastic product. It's great to be a part of it, but tough loss.
I might pick a couple of frustrations I would have about it though, specifically the final. First one, why is it a week after the semi-final is what I can't get my head around anymore. I'm not even talking about, like, from your point of view, preparing a team and stuff like that. I just think, like, driving the energy, having a 2 week build-up would be so much better. And part of that equation as well is with it now being a double header with the women's final. The women's final is being played now the day after the final game of the Six Nations, which rules out, I know your top Ireland internationals are no longer playing in that women's final, but there are a handful of players on the fringe who could have been available if that game was a week later, because they mightn't have got enough minutes in the Six Nations and stuff like that. I'm almost certain the Irish coaches weren't there, for example, as well, because they were either just back or still coming back from Edinburgh the day before. I remember 2 years ago when Terenure beat Clontarf in the final. That was the first time in a while where there has been a 2 week build up from a semi final to a final, and just seeing it around the locality, around the club, it did so much to just drive the buzz, having an extra week of everyone to get involved and enjoy the fun and kind of be completely riled up with excitement by the time the day arrived.
Yeah, I think the week break, like, it was a long week, you know. So okay. I'd love to have played it last Sunday morning, the one before. But, like, it is a very fast turnaround for something that you're trying to give a real strong preview, get your narrative right for the week, get your selection right. And, like, it is a difficult turnaround. But, like, we did it last year, and we were very happy with the week turnaround, yep, because I think it suited us last year. I don't think it didn't suit us this year, by the way. It's the same for both teams. But it's a tight squeeze, even though you have an extra day. We're involved in the Junior Cup final again on this week on Saturday. So, like, the club was hopping and there's a lot of people around the training and everything else, but there's a lot of management in that. And then, to your point, like, the build-up of it, it does go under the radar a small bit more when you're trying to turn it around within 8 days of semi-finals. And the semi-finals are a big show at the best of times. You know, they're cracking games. Last year, our game against Clontarf was probably, I know we came out on the right side of it, so maybe there's a bit of subjective bias there, but probably the greatest game in the AL that I've been involved in. Like, the sun was out. It was, I was scored 40-34 or something like that. It was a cracker of a game. The way the game was played in Conn, the sun was out and the sun hits the kind of the bar area there after a game, just the way the timing goes. And people were out having points afterwards. It was a great spectacle, you know. So the semi-finals are big in their own right. So turning it around for 8 days, it can be tough. So I take your point. And it's more so the women's game. I mean, the earlier rounds are over for a while, aren't they? And then getting across the Six Nations and kind of getting in the way there, it could probably be managed a little bit better for them. Like, we're not in any rush to play it either. Like, you know, there's nothing happening in May. there's a long summer for amateur players. Like, you know, so as much as I don't mind turning it around quickly, because things drag on, I understand that it could be used differently too.
Yeah, and I don't think the May bank holiday factors into it, because it has been on the bank holiday Sunday before as well, and that hasn't, you know, there have been decent attendances on those Sundays when it has been. If you build it, they will come. The other frustration I have, and this is more so just down to like something on the day, 90%, 95% of the supporters were sitting on the side of the stadium that the TV camera was on. I was over on the far side, one of about, I'd say about 500 people max, who were sitting over on that far side. And it just looked terrible on TV. And there actually was a solid enough crowd there, but they were all just obviously on the side of the pitch that you and the coaches would have been, for example. And I don't know, I just thought it looked like it just didn't look right.
Yeah.
Particularly for the trophy celebrations, where you've Clontarf players lifting the trophy and there's kind of nobody behind them in the background, when there actually is a gigantic cohort of Clontarf fans celebrating like mad.
Yeah, it's funny, because like when Terenure were in it, they actually brought an enormous amount of people, so we just didn't have that issue because they were probably on both sides, you know. Because I remember last year there was just a lot more Carcon people standing behind me, whereas Clontarf took over different areas of that stand. So it felt small but different, but there was no one on the far side. Like, Terenure went over the far side, happy out, doing their own thing, you know. So I do get what you're saying. I just think the numbers are probably lower. I don't know the stats on that, but I'd say the numbers are just lower as well.
Yeah, but like small, but I it's more, I would say, like try funnel supporters as much as possible over to that side of the ground. But that's a small little nitpick anyway. After look, brilliant final. Congrats on a great season. I can't wish you too much luck this weekend in the Junior Cup final. Old Crescent is my home club in Limerick, so
we just like to support anyone we're against, really.
Right, we'll move it on to a disappointing weekend for the provinces. The URC hit Irish rugby with a slap on the chops on Friday and Saturday. Four games, four defeats. Started in Cardiff on Friday night, Munster beaten 22-21. Then on Saturday, Connacht lost 26-7 away to the Lions. Leinster's second string were then well beaten in Clonethly, 35-22 by the Scarlets. And then Ulster, 19-0 up at home to the Sharks in Belfast. The Sharks come back to win 22-19. Bernard, it has no material impact on Leinster, really. They're eight clear at the top. But as it stands, only one Irish province is now in the top half of the table with two games to play. I'd like a penny for David Humphrey's thoughts this week.
Yeah, I'd say he's saying that David Nisifor gave him a hospital pass. You know, he's inherited, obviously, a tricky situation in that he's, by all accounts, trying to balance the books. I think there's a focus on spend. I think there was a far higher spend across the board under David Nusafora, and that led to probably stronger provincial sides, I would say, than we see at the moment. I think it's not. I'd be shocked. Hopefully, it doesn't finish up with only one Irish team in the top eight. But if it did, that would be a dark day for Irish rugby. Given the state of the game in other places, I mean, the South Africans have recruited really well. And there's obviously not lots of natural talent there, but they're under massive pressure to try and get their top players balanced in terms of the amount of games they play and how many rest periods they get, etc. So the likes of the Sharks, you know, they were very strong on Friday, Saturday night in Belfast, but for large periods of the season they can't play them because there's a limit of how much training weeks they can have and how many games they can have. So I'd like to hope we end up with two, but I just think it's look, Leinster first choice beats Scarlets, but realistically, we don't want to be just one strong Irish province. We want to have three plus one, so four in total. You know, being in the top eight. That's what I think we should be pushing for, particularly given how the game is being financed elsewhere. So David Humphreys has got a big ask. I know one of his big things is putting a GM in each province, but I think that's more middle to long term. Short term, I think they need talent. And it was interesting, I listened to a podcast with on Scrum 5 with Dave Redden, the new director of rugby for the WRU, and he's got a vast amount of experience in high performance sport. Was part of Clive Woodward's management team in 2003, then was head of high performance for the Great Britain Home Olympics in London, as being involved in football, etc. But what something he said to me was, you know, what we as the WRU need to give our coaches is a vision, a challenge, and support. Right. And I'll just say, in a season where we've lost two head coaches, you have to make an assumption, because we won't ever hear from Graham Rowntree or Pete Wilkins. We won't really ever hear from them. But like, ask a question, are we giving our coaches absolute clarity in terms of division, possibly the challenge? Yeah, the challenge is obvious, but the support, you know, the support from above, the support in terms of players, the support in terms of resources to allow them go and do their job. And I think maybe we aren't. It's, you know, it's a season where we've had two interim coaches in the provincial sides, but I think that's a factor of what we've seen over the last couple of years in terms of not being able to hire or keep their best players because of budget. So definitely something this summer, I think, after this tour to Georgia and Portugal, that it'd be great if the four CEOs, the four head coaches, the four general managers, and David Humphreys and whoever else from the RFU is needed to get into a room and make sure that people understand what the vision is for each province, the challenge that'll come from the vision, and then obviously what support is there. So players are getting that consistency. And in some ways, it probably leads into me probably having, you know, I was angry with Munster and Connacht probably at the weekend. Less so Ulster, because I thought Ulster probably put their best foot forward. But now midweek, I'm thinking, in situations I've been in before where, you know, there has been that disruption, the head coach isn't in place for the following season, it does affect performance. If it didn't, everyone would be chopping and changing all the time. You know, the odd time, France is probably a country where that turmoil tends to work better than Ireland. So if you look at Racing, you know, Stuart Lancaster left, Patrice Collazo comes in, Racing get out of the relegation zone. You know, it's quite common. Montpellier a couple of years ago, you know, made a late change and saved themselves from an impossible situation. Whereas in Ireland, we tend to like consistency and clarity. And it's a season where we haven't had that. And it looks like at the moment it's affecting our results. But I do think Munster will get in, but it's still not great to be scraping away trying to get into the top eight when you're Munster. You know, Munster are better than that. Have to be historically better than that, and have to be historically, or have to be in the future better than that.
And Johnny, I know people might point out, like, talking about the gulf between Leinster and Munster in terms of resources and central contracts and all the big picture IRFU stuff. But I do think you can make a fair point that even if you look at the squad of players Munster have, they are better than ninth place in the URC after 16 games with 7 wins and 9 defeats.
Absolutely. I wrote about Ulster last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago, about, you know, they haven't had a full squad to choose from. They've been obliterated with injuries and key injuries at certain times. That, like, Munster have gone through all that as well, but they just, at the time, had a bigger squad, better squad, better quality. Ulster don't have that. Like, you look at their bench at the weekend, and you look at why they're dropping off at 60 minutes against teams, like, it's fairly obvious, like, isn't it? Like, you know, that might not sound fair to certain personnel involved, but that's the reality of the level that they're at, and the resources that they have. They've gone through a very difficult year, but I don't believe Munster have that same problem. Like, they went ahead at a crucial part of the game in the second half last week, and they let that slip. Like, that's, I don't think it's a personnel issue. Like, you know, I think they have the squad to be better tonight in the URC, and I think that's why, you know, there was a lot of there was a dark enough dressing room by all accounts in Munster or in Cardiff last weekend, and these are the reasons why. They know they're better than that. I don't think they have as big a not an excuse, I suppose, but the external factors aren't as strong with them, like, you know, and they know it's within their own control. So I think that's probably why they're feeling quite down about it, you know. But I think rightly they should be feeling quite down about it. They are better than that, and that's a compliment, you know. But Ulster, like, at the same time, like, Bert, you're right that Ulster are kind of fighting above themselves at the moment, but they went 19-0 up, like, and the way they didn't like get blitzed either. It was just a soft, a kind of a slow defeat in the end, like, wasn't it? And they really could have seen it out. I love the way Jacob Stockdale played, by the way. He did 3-on-1, and he chipped it ahead, and then he executed it too. Oh, he was looking at it going, "You cannot do that," and to get away with it just shows where his confidence is at, that he's playing some rugby.
is. He is absolutely flying it, and I'll come back to him a little bit later on. It's such an interesting stat from Ross Petty on X a few days ago. Connacht, Munster, and Ulster against non-Irish opposition in the URC regular season matches in 2021-22, 24 out of 36 wins. Following season, 27 out of 36 wins. Last season, 25 out of 36 wins. This season, Bernard, 14 out of 32 wins so far. So I know the Irish teams are kind of, they are playing at a handicap, if you want, by having to play an extra game against Leinster, for example, than everyone else does and stuff like that. And I think that factors in sometimes into the table. But this season has been about how the Irish provinces are losing games that they should and historically have been winning against Welsh regions who have not been in a good place for several years.
Yeah, and to be honest, like this Welsh revival last weekend, but it's not like the Ospreys have been having quite a good season as well. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they beat the Dragons at the weekend in a Welsh derby, but it's testament to them and their fight because they've had no external support. So, you know, Welsh rugby's been in crisis. And all that's happened in the meantime is one other crisis, Cardiff going to administration. And this week, obviously, they announced the DOR. They're still to find a head coach at the national level. There's still no agreement signed between the WRU and the regions. And yes, they've galvanised. They've been resilient. I thought the quality of rugby that Cardiff played in attack and Scarlets defensively and attack-wise against Leinster was excellent. So fair play to them because they haven't had the perfect scenario. Now, at first, I would say they're more used to chaos and change than maybe we are. But it still doesn't excuse like our province is dropping off that significantly in terms of competing with the rest because they haven't gone and improved their pathways. They haven't gone and signed X-Factor non-Irish qualified players. They haven't gone and brought back players from who were playing outside of Wales, for example. They've just actually really gritted their teeth and developed their game plan and shown lots of fight and spirit and fair play to them, you know, fair play to them. But I'm excusing our players a little bit by saying they probably need more support in terms of talent and all that stuff. But I also do think there's an element of, you know, they need to now really put their shoulder to the wheel and knuckle in for the next 2 weeks, two rounds, and try and salvage this because, and unfortunately, potentially Ulster and Munster will knock one of each other out in the next round, you know. I think probably they need to win two to qualify. So Munster need to beat Benetton and Ulster. And obviously if Ulster lose, it's going to be very difficult for them against Munster. So that's the reality of it. But you'd love to see real doggedness. And then obviously if you qualify for the top eight, go and do something in the playoff. But at the moment where we are now, it's hard to say that the other three provinces are geared up to go and win the URC this year. You know, and not even probably maybe not even make a semi-final or final.
Johnny, is it? I know this is something we talked about a couple of weeks ago. A two-week break between matches. Is it a good or a bad thing from a Munster point of view to have 2 weeks until this game against Ulster? Would they have rather just got straight out this weekend?
Yeah, I probably would have preferred to go straight into it. I think you know when things felt so bad last weekend. I don't know how positive it is to be stewing on that. Yeah, you get like time to get your ducks in a row and prepare and have your previews done and be very clear on what you're trying to do, but so do the opposition. Like, you know, so I think some of that hurt could have been channeled very, very easily into the Ulster game, going back home. And I think, unfortunately, I don't know how afraid of Thomond Park Ulster are. You know, I think they've had their moments in Thomond Park, and Ulster are, you know, we've seen them cause teams trouble, although they haven't, like I said, done it for 80 minutes. They have caused teams trouble. So if they get really gritty as well, which they're going to have to do, as Burke said, they could be really difficult. So I would have thought that the emotional side to that Munster would have been better off maybe just turning it around straight away, but that's not within their control. I still think they have so much quality that, you know, they should be expecting at this stage to beat Ulster, a weakened Ulster side, if you want to put it that way. They still have a very good starting 15, and it depends on what's available to them. But even the vibe in Ulster, like a lot of people being let go, leaders within the squad, that can work both ways. Like, will they give their last bit to the Ulster jersey, or are they a little bit pissed off? Like, who knows? So it could go either way, but I think Munster have too much quality then to be defeated on the second last game of the season where they really need to win.
Go ahead.
Just like Munster have always been an emotional side, right? And when they're at their best, they mix that emotion with really good technical and tactical ability, right? But if you look at this season, I think they've had to go to the well emotionally a lot. So you've had that, like, crazy loss to Zebre. You've had, you know, a South African tour afterwards, which probably, you know, was probably would have caused a lot of stress and anxiety around the performance. Obviously, then Graham leaves, you're a bit of a bounce after that without ever really having massive highs, you know, and beat Stade Francais at home, etc. Then they had build up to Northampton, they go toe to toe with Northampton, but lose. And then, you know, then you have the Edinburgh match where it's like, it's probably the worst performance I've ever seen Munster have in Cork, you know, where they're absolutely bullied. It's not Munster-like. Then they bounce back, you know, La Rochelle's obviously a massive high. Then you have Bordeaux the week after where they didn't look to be as emotionally there as they were against La Rochelle, but also massive weakness in their game, their line out, their defence gets exposed. And then you, like, then you think, oh, we've got a run in now. We've got three games to go to make top eight. And you have a game against Cardiff where, again, it's technically not good. The line out again is a weakness. Some of the tries they conceded are quite poor. You see the frustration between Tyburn and Scannell. You know, you can actually see that frustration. And again, it's a case of what is the leadership group like? Can this coaching staff, which are interim as such, can they harness that now to go again? Or are they kind of just emotionally fatigued? And if they take that away, and then you have the other elements of your game are creaking, like as I said, mainly set piece, mainly line out and your defensive systems, it's hard then to build any confidence, you know. So Ulster, I think Johnny's right. Ulster will see so many opportunities to get into the game against Munster, and normally I would say, oh yeah, Munster will react, and Munster will get it done, and we'd be saying, well, what were we worried about? But just there's been so many highs and lows this season. You know, you have to question, are the players able to get it right again?
I might bring it back, Johnny, to 2016. I'm 99% certain you would have been playing in this match as well. It went down to the last game of the season. You had to beat a Welsh team.
Scarlets.
And you got the job done. I think it was bonus point win, but you had to win that final game to just get Champions Cup. Can I bring you back to then to just, like, even think about the pressure you were feeling that week as potentially a Munster team that could miss out on Champions Cup rugby, and what that level of pressure was like over the course of the week?
Yeah, it was a funny one. Like, we were in a strange place. Like, we had played well in a couple of games before that. Like, we lost to Connacht up in Connacht sports ground. We lost to Leinster in the Aviva narrowly, which would have been a lovely win. We beat Edinburgh and Cork, I think, the week before. And then Scarlett. So I was in a very weird place anyway, because I was on the verge of retirement. I just didn't know it. I was hanging on. So I was in my own head. I remember the Edinburgh week, I nearly pulled out of it, and I didn't. I just about got going. Added Walters, added one more warm-up with me, and I got going and training on the Thursday. And the Scarlets week, myself and Keats were both injured, and Axel just said, well, it's one or the other. Like, you know, one of you has to train. And I remember being hanging. Like, I couldn't train, but I had to. And that's kind of what was going on. Like, it was desperation stuff. But there was a huge pressure. Now, like, I was was probably my first kind of season in the jersey itself. Like, you know, so I was in a different kind of way. Like, more experienced players might have been able to reflect on different seasons and deal with the pressure. But I remember thinking, like, I can't be part of the first Munster side, you know, not to make the Champions Cup or whatever else. So there's a massive relief after it. Huge relief, but I'd say it hit other fellas more than hit me. I just remember I played the worst game of my life in Scariness, and it was the last game I ever played. So you can cry with me on that one. But it was very strange to have Scariness come to Thomond Park, and you could well have been out of the competition, like, you know. So it just felt like it wasn't something that was supposed to happen, Munster, and here we are nearly writing history for the wrong reasons. Like, so I think there was a bit of a reaction. A lot to do with Axel as well. I think, like, he was under pressure, and was probably a reaction on his part and everything else. It's not a nice environment to be in, though. You know what I mean? Like, it's a really hard environment. It nearly gets to the stage where you want the end of the season to come. And all it is relief. Get out of it and get back into the next one. And I was thinking that when Bert was speaking, like, for the coaches in Munster and some of the players, you're nearly going, can we just get out of here? You know, get out of here in a half a positive. Get into the playoffs. Have a crack off it and just wipe the slate clean. I know you don't get to do that in professional sport. Some people won't be there next year and everything else, and everyone has a different kind of agenda within the agenda, but it does certainly feel like, you know, you want to fast forward, play the Ulster game, get your results, have one last crack off it, see where you end up, not have it be too negative, you know, get into the playoffs, whatever happens after that happens, and get into the next season where they can tidy things up.
Birch, what it does do though is it sets next week's game at Thomond Park up to be an absolute cracker of an occasion. For a Friday night game, which unfortunately probably might limit the amount of travelling fans that can make it up for Cork or from the wider province as well, but there has to be a cracking atmosphere at Thomond Park next Friday evening. And this is as it's probably trying to remember when was the last Munster Ulster game that probably had this much riding on it. Could
That's
potentially be that Champions Cup quarter final back in 2012.
yeah, I'd say it is. I actually thought, I think, I know I'd be critical of the loss to Cardiff, but I think that the La Rochelle game has done a lot for the connection between Munster and their fans again. I think, you know, that rekindled an old love. And I thought in the Bulls game, which they obviously lost in the end, but I just thought the crowd were just waiting for anything positive from Munster's point of view to get behind them, you know. And I think they'll be back again next Friday night, and it will be a partisan crowd, and that could be the difference. But they will need him. They will need him because, as I said, I think Ulster probably have resigned themselves that it's highly unlikely they're going to make it. Or certainly a couple of weeks ago, you know, they were definitely in a full rebuild. But that makes them dangerous because they've got unbelievable X factor, out wide, and as we said, Munster have a tendency to concede a lot of points, and you have a player like Stockdale who just is back to being world class. And like, let's not forget that Sharks team, they're flawed, but they have world class operators playing there. And he was probably the player driving back down the road that probably stood out to me the most, you know, and that's testament to how good he is again. And as Johnny said, smile on his face, confident, playing fullback, and he is a danger man. Dennis Leamy will be, you know, previewing him and talking about how they can't kick loosely to him and how off transition they gotta connect quickly defensively because he will rip teams apart.
What I'm loving about Stockdale at the moment, Johnny, is like he's trying all the things that he was trying back in 2018 and 19. And like those little chips over the top, the grubber kicks in behind, those brilliant hard running lines popping up everywhere. It kind of went out of his game for a few years when he lost that bit of confidence, when he was going through the injury problems, when the tries had dried up. It's rare we kind of actually see this with players where they break out really, really young, you know, explode onto the scene, tail off for a couple of years. It's rare we actually see them kind of have that renaissance in the, what is he now, 27, 28, I'm going to say maybe. What, he was an under 20 in 2016. Yeah, probably late 20, you know, 28, I'm going to put on him. I don't know exactly, but it's great to see players kind of just like find that all over again.
Yeah, he's actually really enjoyable to watch at the moment. Hopefully not in Thomond Park, you know, but he's It's very enjoyable to watch. I laughed at the 3v1, like the audacity to chip it over the top. It's an easy pass inside or outside. I'd say coaches are pulling their hair out for a split second, like. But even, I know he's doing some mad things that you shouldn't get away with. That clearance from his 22 that just about dropped outside the pitch. But like, in fairness to him, I think he had covered the length of the pitch a couple of times before he actually kicked that ball. So there's a lot more to it than just having a wide exit. But he is like he glides across the ground. He's a left footer as well. There's a bit of uniqueness about him. Like when you're previewing an opposition team and there's a left footer like that, a full back or wherever you can't predict where he's going to play either. Like so, it's a difficulty when you're previewing teams or a player like Jacob Stockdale. It just adds another dimension to what you think you have to watch out for, and it makes you somewhat nervous. Like I'm sure the Munster defence and their coaches and teams and people will be thinking, ah, oh, it would be no harm now if this fella just pulled up with something in training. It'd be one less thing, one less headache to worry about.
The as I think you kind of hinted at it earlier on as well, Bernard, the like the difference between Ulster and the Sharks, as much as frustrating as it is to see Ulster give up a 19-point lead, you could just see it kind of coming as the game was developing on, because the gulf in power was just absolutely enormous, and bit by bit over the course of the game, even when Ulster went 19-0 ahead, there was that part of you in the back of your head thinking they probably need to get to half time at the very least with this intact. And I suppose it's just the obvious issue where the game went away from them.
Yeah, and that's what power does. It actually in the Six Nations it was starting to have an effect with teams using their benches a little bit earlier in the third quarter, but here we saw that the from 50 minute on, it was just one way traffic. And I actually haven't seen a team who faded physically as much as Ulster did. And I understand why. There's, I mean, even the scrummage and their scrum in the first 50, 60 minutes was incredible. But the effort, obviously, that they had to put in to be solid and not creak against more physically powerful, bigger men took its toll. And, that Julius try, just the pace that actually Sharks looked to be quicker than they were in the first 60 and more powerful and more dynamic. And Ulster just like looked like they were dead. There was holes everywhere. And that's why the bench is so important. That's why. You'll see Jordy Barrett on the bench this weekend for Leinster, amongst others, maybe RG Slimen as well. Because coaches know that it's over 80 minutes that it will tell. And yeah, Ulster, Johnny said, it's no disrespect to that Ulster bench, but they just didn't have the firepower to come on. And it must have been very frustrating for Richie Murphy and his coaches, because I thought they put together a really good game plan. And sometimes you can just hang on. You can hang on. But it just, the level of fatigue that they had and the difference between the Sharks bench and the Ulster bench was so great. Even being 19-0 up, it's just not enough. It's just not enough. That firepower was too much. And it's why Sharks, if they could iron out some obvious weaknesses in their game, they could go toe-to-toe with anyone in this competition, But at the moment, they're so flawed, it's hard to have any faith in them. Like, you look at the Bulls, the Bulls are obviously much more regimented in how they play. You don't give teams as many ins, and that led to a lovely tour over here where they went back to back with wins in Munster and Glasgow. Whereas the Sharks, okay, they got a win in Edinburgh and they got a win in they got a win in Belfast, but the form of that isn't as strong. So also the content of the performances are vastly different. You'd fancy the Bulls way more than the Sharks at the moment, but still being very respectful for the absolute quality that the Sharks have with Estebet and a few more still to come in.
Yeah, the Sharks are like the great enigma in the URC, where on paper they probably have the only squad that could rival Leinster's, but just can't seem to stitch it together over the course of the season. Who knows what might happen over the next few weeks, though. Connacht, I think we can scratch them off now. Edinburgh at home and Zebre away in the next two matches. They're 6 points off the playoffs, but even if they do win out those two games, Johnny, there are just too many teams ahead of them who are likely to be picking up points at various stages as well. So it's not even a case for Connacht of, win those two games and you're probably okay. Other teams are probably going to stay ahead of them along the way as well.
Yeah, I think like I haven't gone through all of them now, but when you look at some of the fixtures like Ulster and Munster, like one of them teams have to win. So like you look at, we talked about the AIL earlier, but like you'd be used to looking at tables going, well, one of them will have to win and they'll pick up points there and you kind of make a few predictions. I think when you do that across the URC, like it's not looking well for Connacht, who've had a difficult tour, difficult season. And again, we're talking about We're talking about squad depth to a degree, but like I think, you know, they shouldn't be down as far as they are. Like I'm sure other countries do say things about Irish rugby that they're, you know, they're privileged and they're looked after well and there's a great system there. But at the moment we're not seeing the best of that, and Connacht are at the bottom part of that system at the moment. And I just don't think it's not good enough for some of the players that they have. Like, you know, I know there's been issues in the background, coaching staff leaving and different bits and pieces like that. As Bernard said earlier, like Irish people aren't used to that bit of turmoil. Like we do like the consistency of it. It's kind of going, you know, what are we supposed to do here? Like we're up against another coach left as opposed to the reaction to it. But I don't think it's good enough for Connacht to be that far down. We've come to respect Connacht way more than that. They should be punching into that top eight and expecting to do that, you know.
Yeah, and Birch, we spoke about it last week. I think I thought your line dropped there for a second. We spoke about it last week about Connacht and how we were still giving them a crack at getting into those playoffs because we spoke about the bonus points, 15 bonus points, way more than anyone else in the competition, and how even when they weren't performing well, even when they were struggling defensively, they were always staying in fights and having a shot that if they could just stitch together a consistent 20 minutes at the end of a game, they could come out the other side. That's probably what was the most frustrating part of Saturday because we gave them a great chance last week. They just didn't fire a shot on Saturday.
Yeah, I thought they could win with a 5-pointer because the lines are kind of up and down as well. Connacht generally attack well enough to get a attacking bonus, and I thought it would be enough, but it was just a game where their attack, first time this season, yeah, bar Ulster at home, where I thought their attack was just really just didn't function, didn't function, didn't look like it was going to be threatening. Their energy levels look poor, and whether, like, you know, they had a great performance attack wise against the Stormers, who are a better side in the Lions. And you just thought, okay, this group have obviously, you know, circled the wagons. They've gone to South Africa with a point to prove. Some of them haven't played for a long time, and they want to prove a point for contracts or selection for the end of the season. And it was just another dip, you know, it was just another dip down again. And it was different than the Racing game, or, you know, or the Stormers game, or the Munster game, McHale Park, where you could just be critical of them for letting teams get way ahead, or being ahead against Racing and not being able to close it out. They just never played. They never played. It was different than normal defeats for Connacht, and they finished with nothing. And now it's done. You know, I was thinking that maybe another 2 points or 5 points or 4 points would have had them, you know, still in the hunt. But it's done now. And I mean, you think, you know, I think Johnny's right. But like Zebra, who've had an unbelievable turmoil this season with the serious risk of extinction. You know, players who have 2-year contracts being told no in June, that'll be null and void because we're going into receivership. And now it looks like maybe they've saved themselves. But the players have done that. The players have far exceeded their budget and their talent. And that'll kill Connacht because Connacht have always, sorry, constantly maximized, I would have said, their talent. And they've got a great new stadium, a great new training facility, but they'll probably be heading into it on the back of another disappointing season.
Yeah, and they've got Edinburgh next up on Saturday week. Maybe not must win for Connacht anymore, given their playoff chances look doomed, but must win for everyone else, I would say, around them, because that is a very important game for
That
a
one you
handful of
do.
teams in the in that kind of mid fat middle section of the URC. Let's move it on to Leinster. Not really going to talk about Leinster and Scarlets because you know, Leinster are going to finish top of the URC. It feels a little bit irrelevant. Leinster Northampton round two this weekend. Johnny, Northampton came very, very close last season to pulling off a massive shock at Croke Park. Are they a better team this year than they were last year? The Premiership table would suggest that maybe they have fallen off ever so slightly. But do they still have that firepower that they would have had last season to be able to punch holes in a team like Leinster if it clicks?
The firepower to beat Leinster, I'm not sure they do. I think they're missing a couple of players, aren't they? I was looking this morning, like Furbank is out, Sladeholm is out, it's Hendy out. So they're when you look at the back three that actually can cause a lot of that problem, they're missing some key players there. But you know, I think when you just it's less so about Northampton, because I do think, like, listening to their coaches and everything else, I do think they'll come with a game plan that will cause Leinster some trouble. I think Leinster play a certain defensive system, like we saw with Scarlets last week. I know not a first string Leinster side, but they play a unique way that you can come with a seriously clear plan. but it still might not work out for you. And it still comes down to personnel. And then it also comes down to the fact that Leinster's squad, when you look at what they're going to be picking for this weekend, what they're playing for in terms of the disappointment of the last couple of seasons, I just can't see it. You know, Northampton will trouble them at times, but not across 80 minutes they won't. And that's the way I see it.
You're nodding your head, Bernard.
Yeah, I don't see how Leinster could lose this game. It'd be a massive, massive shock. And that's not disrespecting Northampton. I think they have the potential to put in a really good performance. But this Leinster team, based on Harlequins, Glasgow, rested up, the quality they have, you know, Barrett on the bench, Porter on the bench, RG probably on the bench, the quality of the starting team, Kelleher on the bench. It's mind-boggling how strong they are, and they should win it this year. Like unbelievably consistent, but they have an unbelievable head coach in Ian Abar. Blindale's hitting his straps. Cullen's keeping it all together. Hurt from the last couple of years, but just quality. Quality of player. There's,
you look at if we perform and they perform. If they perform, it's very hard to see anyone beating them. But like Northampton don't have. If Northampton is their best, Leinster don't. I would say they can go below their best and still win this game. So like if Leinster turn up and perform, I think that's what their message should always be. Like, you know, if we turn up this weekend, we will win the game, and that has to be true.
You were talking about players there, Berners. So you reckon Jordy Barrett will be on the bench, Snyman on the bench. You said Porter on the bench. Do you think they're going to go with that 20 minutes, that 20 minutes?
Yeah, I think he'll play 20 minutes. I'm not sure about Snyman, but I think Barrett will be on the bench. Yeah, I think he will. And it's not arrogance. It's effectively the key period is the last 30, and Leinster will be able to have Porter definitely finishing the game, I would say, bar an injury for him. Barrett finishing the game. And if they do get in a situation like they got into last year against Northampton, where for whatever reason, I think they're better than they were last year in that semi-final, but if for whatever reason the game isn't done and dusted, having that kind of quality there, along with the Dorris and the Van der Fleers, etc., who'll probably play 80, it has to be enough to get done, particularly with Northampton. You know, Northampton have lost Courtney Laws and Ludlow. Like, Northampton aren't as good. I thought last year Northampton were building towards the end of the season really well. There was obviously the premiership that they added on to it after that. But just looking at Northampton's form, are they capable of putting in a big performance? Yes. But like, you would argue they're not even the best team in England at the moment. Based on the premiership, they're a bit off that. So you know, this home game for Leinster, as I said, only one focus now, which is to win silverware for Leinster. Last weekend before the Lions selection, on the back of a loss, even though it wasn't this group of players, just to focus the mind. It couldn't be better for them in terms of the ideal scenario. You would want a decent injury profile. Yeah, like, unfortunately, that puts massive pressure on Leinster. And until they win a couple of titles, you're probably always going to have that slight doubt around their ability to deal with pressure and momentum. But I just can't see how. I could see him coming on stuck maybe in a final against Toulouse, but I don't think Northampton or Bordeaux will live with them.
Another selection one for you, Bernard. Does Tommy O'Brien start in the right wing, or are they going to go with that Jamie Osborne selection at 14?
I don't know. I have no inside track in this, but I'd love to see Tommy play. I think he deserves it. He gets something totally different. And it would be a reward for someone who's kind of gone and played in less talented teams and just earned his right. So yeah, I would have Jamie on the bench, and I'd have although that's tough with Barrett on the bench as well. But
Barrett on the bench as well.
Yeah, it might be a 4-4 split this week for Leinster. no, I'm joking. I think Frawley, yeah, I don't know what they'll do. I don't know. Frawley might miss out on the bench. Yeah, I don't know what. I don't know if Jamie. I don't know. I don't know what the bench is, Jamie or Tommy starts, but I would go with Tommy.
Johnny, I would be thinking if Jordy Barrett is on the bench, then Jamie Osborne probably does miss out if he isn't starting, because you obviously need an extra. You need your 10 in there as well.
Yeah, and
or is Jordy Barrett your sub 10 if needed?
I don't know the people. I've seen this on X, I call it Twitter. Oh, Leinster bringing in a 10. They did not bring in a 10. Like, you've got the wrong Barrett. But like, he could cover there, but not in the European semi final. You know, so no, I don't believe so. But Tommy O'Brien, how do you leave that guy out of the team? With the way, it's not even like some of the moments he's had, but it's just sheer want and grit. And I think like a team like Leinster getting that balance right with a fella like that just chasing everything down. I'd love to see him play. I think it's the right call. You're kind of going with form and rewarding things. I know it's hard to go with Leinster, go with form and Leinster, because they don't pick everyone every week, you know, so maybe they have just a different way of doing it. But I would see, I would have seen Frawley under pressure unless you can find a different way to cover that thing for that, you know.
You obviously, Bernard, a couple of minutes ago, you were talking about how Leinster have to, you know, talk about potentially playing at Toulouse in the final as well. I don't know, did you see Piato Mavaca now out for the rest of the season as well? He's after doing his ACL. So Toulouse now for the rest of the campaign are without DuPont and Piato Mavaca, two of their
potentially
best players.
Potentially Cap Watso.
Oh, yes, of course, injured in the Six Nations.
Yeah, I'd only say he may be back in the final, but like Mavaca, that's massive because, again, just look at what Leinster would bring. They'd bring Dan Kelleher, and then you have, you know, Mavaca, Marsha, DuPont is obviously a joke in terms of what he can do. So they are, they're suffering a little bit. And that's unfortunately the challenge when you've got so many internationals, and then the top 14 is so intense as well. I know Toulouse have got a bit of a lead, and they have rotated a little bit during the year, but they've kind of rotated by sending really weak teams a couple of times, rather than trying to mix it up as much as maybe some of the other teams do. So and those weak teams have actually been quite successful at being competitive. But Mavaca being out, just flashed up my phone during his pod. He is a big loss. He's top class.
But it heightens the sense, throw in the signings as well.
Yeah.
DuPont being gone for Toulouse, this does heighten the sense that if ever there was a year where the stars are aligning for Leinster to go and do it, this has to be it.
100%. 100%. Yeah. I think not to do it this year. It'd be hard. Look, I admire how they've recovered from the last couple of defeats, because they've been, you know, obviously gut-wrenching. They've been competitive in all finals, more than competitive. But you see what's happened elsewhere. You have a home semi-final again. And Bordeaux kind of nouveau riche this level, you know, it'll be Bordeaux's first Champions Cup final, and to lose without some key players, it has to be this year.
All right, we will leave it there. Before I go, in one word, who's playing each other in the Champions Cup final? Johnny, you can go first.
One word, but two teams, is it? Leinster.
one sentence.
Yeah, agree. Agree.
All right. We'll leave it there. Champions Cup semi-final, Leinster and Northampton on Saturday from 4:45 p.m. on RT2 and RT Player. Live blog as well on the RT News app. And you can listen to live commentary on Saturday Sport as well. Coming up next in the podcast, I will be speaking to Ireland and Leinster prop Linda Dugan. Delighted to be joined now by Ireland and Leinster prop Linda Dugan, off the back of another Six Nations campaign. You're here though today at the Aldi Play Rugby programme. It's been a beautiful day at the Aviva Stadium. Hundreds of kids here. I imagine after a tough weekend, a day like today probably is nice to kind of take your mind away from the weekend.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's actually, today is such a beautiful day, and actually seeing like all the young girls and boys playing out there, I was just so lucky to even be outside. I feel like I needed this now, you know. So it's really good to kind of just put the Six Nations aside and then just really be part of this with Aldi. It's been good, yeah.
It's been well documented you came to rugby late. What sports would you have played when you were a kid?
I didn't really play. I was part of the Lost and Rush Athletic Club, and I did a bit of GAA in school. There was one of the coaches that used to come to the school in primary school and just like coach us some GAA. But I wasn't really into anything until rugby came along.
And as we know, you might tell the story again. You went out playing tag rugby
And you were spotted, and the rest is history. Like, how old were you when you went out playing that game?
I was 18. I went down, I was doing an internship in Grant Thornton, and I put down my name for like a social like activity. And then you just, whatever thing that was going to happen, you just like, your name was there. And that got canceled that Wednesday. But I didn't know how to remove my name from that sheet because everybody else were able to remove their name. And I could see the list. I could see people removing their name, but I didn't know how do I remove my name. And then that Wednesday, that social thing got canceled. And then because their first tag rugby team were playing the final and they needed another girl. And they saw that there was only me that was left on the sheet of paper in the computer. And then they were like, oh, who's Linda? I was like, me. They're like, oh, we're playing the tag like rugby final. Would you like to play? Is it Marion Road? And I didn't know where Marion Road was. I was like, yeah, I play. I didn't know. So I had to go back that afternoon and search what is rugby. So that entire day at work, I was just really Googling and trying to just understand what was the sport. But yeah, it turned out to be like good. I went down to Wanderers, which became my first rugby club, and I played my first tag rugby there, and I was really bad. I was pretty much being the ref. The ref was like, you are so offside all the time, just follow me. So I just kept following the ref around, and my friend actually, McCaffrey, was like, here, they get the ball and run. And I ran like the dog was chasing me. Like, I ran the pitch, and everyone was like, put the ball down, put the ball down. And then I dropped the ball, like, not knowing it, just ran the ball. And then Michelle, which were my Wanderers manager, was there, and she saw me, and she came after the game. She said, oh, would you like to play real rugby? I was like, there's two? What do you mean by real? So she said, oh, we train every Tuesdays and Thursday. And she was super nice. And to be honest, I really love just being able to be part of a team. And even when I was playing with the tag, I just felt part of something. And that's why I even put my name down in Grant Thornton, because I wanted to be part of, like, I wanted to make friends. And to be honest, rugby has allowed me to do that. I went on to play for Wanderers and play for Division 4 there. And played the season with them, and then got asked or scouted for the Leinster trials. So myself and one other of the player in Wanderers went for the Leinster trial, and I got there. And they, to be honest, like, they were really, because we were in Division 4, there was really much. They were just like, you know, and just enjoy, take the opportunity, enjoy yourself and learn. And I remember my first try, I scored a try, and I was like, this is okay. I think I want to push myself. I just don't want to enjoy being part. I actually want to actually do something here. So for me, that was really it. Even my coach was like, nah. Because if you're good, like, you're gonna need to move from like a higher division. Like, yeah. You said, don't do that, don't do that. But like, I didn't even know like the position. Like, I was a flanker, and I didn't even know how to pass the ball. Like, they say, well, fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
But we were doing like passing drills, and oh my god, like, even seeing the young boys and girls passing the ball here and spinning and trying to spin it, and I'm like, I remember that was me trying to spin that ball. But yeah, I made the Leinster squad that year. And that's something that I probably, that year, I never thought that I'll make the score, but I did. And to be honest, that's really where the journey kind of started for me.
I do think it's one of the good things about rugby is that it is a complicated game. There's so many laws, but when you're just starting out, if you can just tell someone, pick up the ball and run, and we'll work on everything else after that.
Yes, yes.
You can pick up the laws along the way. You could pick up the passing along the way.
A lot of people
for now, you could just pick up the ball and go.
Yeah, a lot of people still haven't picked up the law. That law changes every day. You need to keep updating it. And actually, even you saw the monster game there, like the law even for the ref are too much sometimes. But yeah, it's rugby. I just feel like it's just... It's so in niche, what's the word? Like, you just keep changing all the time. Yeah. You need to update yourself all the times. And it's just making the game better, you know. And I try to focus on just what I need to do. And to be honest, the ball and the passing, and that just came with time, you know. Mm-hmm.
Who were the people who kind of helped you along that journey? Because as you say, like, started from fairly humble running rugby beginnings to closing in, fingers crossed, in the next year or so of hitting 50 caps for Ireland.
Yeah, I think that really, I think the coaches really are the one that, if you have really good coaches, they believe in you. They give you the skill to upgrade your game. And I think that I definitely been lucky enough to, like, have those coaches. I think Ben Armstrong, gave me my first Leinster cap. He probably one of my favorite coaches, because I feel like he just allowed me to play my game. You just need one coach to just have that belief in you. And we went on to win that Leinster Interpro Provincial Games, and we went on to play Harlequins in Twickenham. That was my first Leinster try under Twickenham Post. So it was unreal for me. But, like, that didn't come just because he just gave me that opportunity. I felt like he just had that belief in me. And along my journey, I had so many other coaches that just, they bring something different and how far you've gone. And coaches they just uplift your game and they give you that extra. Rugby is, and I think that the beauty of this sport is just that you're never perfect at it. There's always a skill that you need to learn, and you always feel like, I need to improve on this. And I mean, like, that's really what keeps you going.
Are you noticing the kind of wider appeal now around the country? Like, are people recognizing who you are when you and the girls are out and around together?
Yeah,
does that take a little bit of getting used to?
It does take getting used to, but it's also not just me, but the other girls. Like, and it's so good to have, like, people, because the young girls coming through now, like, we're talking to Bevan today, and I was like, I wish I started rugby younger. But it's really that recognition, and that's why you play the sport, you know. It's to really get those young girls playing the sport, and the fact that they're able to recognize you, and that's the impact.
Can you remember the first time you got recognized? Was that a strange feeling?
It was definitely a strange feeling. And I was having dinner at home in our restaurant, in our harbor restaurant, and one of the waitress came up to me, and she's like, oh, I didn't really pay that much attention, and I was thinking, you're just so hungry to eat your food. And she's like, can we have a photo? I just, like, there's this young girl behind that just will love a photo. And I was just really shocked. I was like, what? And I was really, I didn't think that, to be honest, like, you don't really think about it. I don't really think about it, to be honest. Like, I think I'm just like, sometimes, like, I just go on about my day, and she's like, oh, you're late, the club, this, and I'm like, but yeah, it's nice, but it's come with the job.
Yeah, it's something you have to get used to.
It does take a while to get used to, but it's also a nice feeling, and I love to see, like, young girls having that, and because that's what we play the sport for. That's why you're talented, that's why you want that recognition. But it's also, if they recognize you, they're inspired by you, and that's what we want. We want to inspire the next generation and build women's sports, really, and I think that we're definitely heading that way.
There was some tough news this morning. It was confirmed Dorothy Wall's going to miss the World Cup after her injury at the weekend. How disappointed are all of you for her? It's been a tough couple of weeks. Obviously, you lost Aaron for the World Cup as well. And I think pretty much everyone watching the game on Saturday, as soon as Dorothy went down, they knew it wasn't good.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people's kind of hearts just sank in that moment.
Yeah. No, I clearly remember on the pitch, I think it was beside me, and hearing your teammates scream that way, it definitely not something you want to hear. I mean, like, Dorothy has been having such a good tournament, and she's probably my stand-up player, you know, and she's so good. She's all on that leader, and we had to adapt to that, you know, and it's so hard, especially such an important year for us, to have two pivotal player for us going out to injuries and missing out. Like, a World Cup comes every 4 years, you know, and it's something that we've been building on. It's something that we have dreamt on, and something that we have worked really hard to get on, especially like when we didn't qualify a few years ago to go to New Zealand. And I think it, like, Dorothy, and it was part of that journey. And for her, my heart just go out, because I know that we spoke about representing our country at World Cup. We spoke about that dream for us. And it's just, I just feel so gutted for it, because I know that it's been our goal. It's been her goal, you know, and especially the journey that we have all faced, not qualifying for New Zealand, and now have the opportunity to qualify last year, and playing in Scotland, and going to Vancouver, winning against the world champions, and winning in Dubai, the WSV3. And she's been through all of it, you know, and she's that pivotal player for us, and she definitely has stepped up and beyond even what we respect of her, you know, and so she's going to be a great loss.
And I suppose it's just one of those harsh realities of being a professional sports person, that everything can just change like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that it really, for us too, it kind of reminds us, really, you know, that this can be taken just that quickly. And it, like you said, it's also what, it's a sport that we play in. You can't go in and say that you don't want to get injured. Like, we don't think about it. And you try to give everything for your country, like Dorothy was doing and Erin have been doing. And it's just unfortunate. That's just...
You've been incredibly lucky with injuries over the last few years, from what I can tell. I don't think you've missed an Ireland game, not in the Six Nations anyway, ever since you made your debut. Is, like... how much work goes into the prehab, and, you know, before training sessions, after training sessions, making sure everything goes just right?
For me, I've been really lucky but very grateful too. I think, like, your body is your tool, you know, and you always want to make sure that you're 100% and treat your body like it's a temple, like your recovery and everything. But I don't know if it's that or it's just the recovery. It's just it. But I have had injury, but I'm quite lucky that they haven't stopped me from competing. But I would say carrying injury, but still injury that I'm able to perform in it. But yeah, but I wouldn't say I haven't had any injury. But
I suppose all players are carrying various injuries at various times.
Yes, yes.
How pleased are you with your form at the moment? Were you pleased with how you got on in the Six Nations on a personal level?
Definitely. I was quite pleased with how I got on. I think that there's still more to come. Mm-hmm. There's still more in me. What are the
areas you want to get
pretty
better?
Pretty much all of it. I think you can never be good at one. Definitely be working on my ball carrying. It's been a strength of ours, and still something that even though you're good at it, you still want to get better at it. Definitely meter of the ball, scrummaging. We still at such a young age at scrummaging. We definitely want to get more experience at that, and just overall defense, and we're a big defense team, we're a big breakdown team, and breakdown has been massive for us, and it's something definitely that we still work on and still carrying on towards the World Cup. And yeah, that's just really just little but a massive part of our game that I personally just want to keep working on, and also our fitness, and that just comes with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm quite happy with where I am now, but there's still so much more to keep going. Yeah,
how disappointing was Saturday, particularly because it was a game that you dominated to such an extent?
Yeah, it was definitely very disappointing, but we knew why it was disappointing, you know. I think that is something that we can definitely build on. We knew that we probably didn't execute our game plan, and that we have a game plan, and we didn't kick where we needed to kick, or equally take opportunity really where we needed to take those opportunity. I think we definitely are learning. This year Six Nations has been going well for us, and it's also been an eye opening for us to what we can do and where we want to get to. And we're quite lucky that we have another opportunity now during the summer to rectify those mistakes against Scotland.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it probably drives the hunger on even more going into that campaign, that there's no sense of complacency going to creep in after finishing a Six Nations like that.
Yeah, no, it was quite disappointing, but this Six Nations, it was a good Six Nations for us, everybody gave everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't question anyone believe in that team, and the girls really did believe, and the fact that we showed that against England and France, and there's definitely this hunger and this passion, and we know what we're capable of. And now going into the summer, we have two games against Scotland and Canada, and we definitely want to head to the World Cup with a good head on our shoulder. Yeah.
It's a short turnaround until pre-season starts all over again. Early June is what the coaches were telling us last week. What have you got planned for the next few weeks? Because I know Adele and the coaches were telling us last week that people are kind of being told, take a few weeks off, you're going to need it later on in the year.
Yeah, definitely. And I think everyone probably have booked holidays, and I think that they say that, but it's actually true. You do need to take a few, because pre-season, and we probably won't have time after May, when we go back in, to have any days off.
Have you got holidays lined up? What's your plan?
I haven't yet. I need to book, and even everyone say, "Where are you going? Where have you booked?" But I haven't booked it, but I'm hoping to do something soon. Not sure when, where, but it's on my mind. I need to do something. But I definitely will have to do something, because to just get us there, get away, get a bit, it's so beautiful here too, so it's so hard to go
elsewhere. You might even have to leave here if the weather stays this good.
I just need to step away from rugby.
Yeah, absolutely. And to bring everything full circle back to where we started this chat, as someone who started playing rugby in their late teens, how much are you looking forward? How excited are you about the prospect of playing in a World Cup later this year?
I mean, I don't think words can really describe it. Because we've been to such of a journey, and I'm just so grateful to be given the opportunity. I haven't been selected.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's anyone player any dream to be playing at a World Cup, you know, and for me it means a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just that journey, the journey. I think you bring the journey with you, but also the World Cup. Not everyone had the opportunity to play at a World Cup. So for all of us, to be honest, it's massive. It's our first World Cup together.
Mm.
And you just want to really just share with the girls.
And it's so close to home as well.
And it's
in
so
England.
Close,
like,
yes.
Do you have family and friends planning to head over?
Like, it's so, and I'm that also that part where you think about it and we're like, we love for it to be in Australia and New Zealand and all that. But like, will we? Do we? Because it's so close to home. And if it's somewhere else, we might not have the support that mm-hmm. we needed. And we know what it's like to have that home advantage, and we know what it's like to have that home support.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we have it so close to home means that we're able to have easy access to our support. And to be honest, our support this year have been phenomenal. It's been so good, even in Scotland. And we were playing at the Hive, and in such an intense game, just the atmosphere was incredible. And having even that at a World Cup is just, it's electric. And it's something to look forward to. I'm buzzing for it. And I can't wait. I really can't wait. I'm hopefully, like, finger crossed, everything goes well.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be a brilliant summer. Linda, thanks a million for joining
Thank
us on the
so
podcast.
Much.
Enjoy your few weeks holidays.
Thank you.
And enjoy pre-season when it rolls around at the start of June.
Thank you. I definitely try. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. And thank you for having me.
Cheers.